Good morning. You're tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll get a report from last night's Boulder City Council meeting, where the establishment of a police oversight board moved forward. Then, your brain on good food. That's the subject of a discussion being hosted by the Boulder County Area Agency on Aging. It's happening this Thursday. We'll speak with one of the presenters on how what you eat affects your emotional well-being and can also prevent and manage conditions from depression to dementia. Two regular Wednesday morning features, Make Them Hear You and Naturally with Brigitte Mars, will take us to the bottom of the hour. After headlines from the BBC and a commentary from Jim Hightower, we'll hear a forum on sustainability that was hosted recently by Sustainable Resilient Longmont and moderated by KGNU's Liz Lane. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. An 18-year-old male student who was supposed to graduate in 3 days was killed on Tuesday afternoon in the shooting at the STEM school in Highlands Ranch in Douglas County, which left 8 other students injured. The Douglas County Sheriff says the injured students were aged 15 or older. 2 students from the school are being held as suspects. Douglas County Police said last night that one of the suspects is 18-year-old Devon Erickson. A hearing will be held for him this afternoon at 1:30. Douglas County Sheriff Tony Spurlock said this morning that the second suspect is a female juvenile. The shooting was reported just before 2 p.m. on Tuesday, and then the school was put on lockdown until the shooting was over. The uninjured children were bused to a nearby recreation center where they were reunited with their parents. The school, which is K through 12, will be closed for the remainder of the week. The shooting comes just after the 20th anniversary of the Columbine shooting, and it's the 4th school shooting in the state since 1999. Eileen McCarran of Colorado Ceasefire, a gun control advocacy group that was founded in the wake of Columbine, released a statement today saying that a recent resolution by the Douglas County Commissioners has put gun rights ahead of the health and safety of their constituents. In March, the Douglas County Commissioners unanimously adopted a resolution condemning the red flag law, which would allow family members or law enforcement to go before a judge and seek an extreme risk protection order, which would allow someone's guns to be immediately taken away if a person is deemed dangerous by a judge. Douglas County Sheriff Tony Spurlock was one of the main supporters of that legislation. The motives of the STEM school shooters is not yet known. Denver's mayoral race looks like it is headed for a runoff election, with none of the candidates reaching the 50% threshold required to avoid a runoff. As of 5 a.m., incumbent Mayor Michael Hancock had just over 39% of the vote. Jamie Gellis was in second with nearly 26%, followed by Lisa Calderon with just over 17%, and Penfield Tate with almost 15%. Caelan Rose Heffernan got just over 3,200 votes, and Chairman Sekou got 1,025 votes. Nine News reports that this is the first time since 1995 that an incumbent Denver mayor has been forced to compete in a runoff election. A runoff happens between the top 2 candidates, and it's triggered when no candidate gets more than 50% of the votes. Initiative 300, the right to survive measure that would overturn the Denver camping ban, was defeated with almost 83% of voters against the measure. Initiative 301, which would have decriminalized psilocybin, looks like it has also been defeated with just over 51.6% of votes against that measure. 5 city council races and the clerk and recorder race are also headed for the runoff election. The exception for the runoffs are the 2 at-large seats on the city council. In that competition, the top finishers are declared the winners, and those are the incumbents Debbie Ortega and Robin Kniche. The runoff election happens on June 4th. In the weather today, there is a dense fog advisory for the metro area until 9 o'clock today, but fog could linger until about 11 a.m. or noon. Showers in the forecast for the Front Range. Highs in the mid-40s, but will be cooling off overnight when a rain and snow mix comes in, turning to snow showers overnight. And on Thursday, expect temperatures just in the upper 30s with a rain-snow mix and mostly snow coming in Thursday night. On Friday, it will warm up again, getting back up into the mid-50s and getting back to the mid-60s by Saturday. It is 9 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU. Boulder City Council last night moved forward with establishing a police oversight board following a March incident that was viewed as racial profiling. But as KGNU's Ros Brown reports, City Council excluded one person who had been recommended for the board despite objections from public speakers.
Sammy Lawrence was a regular at Boulder City Council meetings until recently, an African-American man who uses a tall walking stick for balance because of seizure-related health problems. Lawrence consistently showed up on Tuesday nights to weigh in at public hearings on issues concerning homelessness. But last month, he was arrested while filming a police officer who was ticketing a group of homeless people. Police viewed his walking stick as a possible weapon and said he ignored commands to move back. His case is now winding its way through the courts. Nonetheless, he was one of 48 Boulderites who submitted an application to sit on the police oversight board, and the selection committee appointed by council put his name forward. Judy Houston told council she thought Lawrence was a perfect fit.
And I think it's really simple for a bunch of folks who don't have any experience living on the street, who don't have any experience living as a young man of color, to lay judgment on this young man. And I have found him to be a delightful human being. And yes, he does have a certain amount of theatricality, but I love it. I think he's kind of the perfect person for the job.
The job, a police oversight board, was initiated after an incident between Boulder police and another black man, a student at Naropa University. Without cause, an officer stopped his patrol car to question Zaid Atkinson on March 1st as he stood in his yard picking up trash, an incident viewed by many as racial profiling. Others believe the second incident with Lawrence has amplified concerns about police behavior toward people of color, but the majority of council voted against his inclusion on the oversight board. Councilwoman Mary Young.
I still feel that Mr. Lawrence should not be appointed to the task force. And the reason is because there seems to be some sort of indication to me that his participation in this task force could be counter to the objectives of being collaborative and contributing member.
Other council members, including Cindy Carlisle and Bob Yates, also voiced their concerns.
So I join with Mary in being disquieted by Mr. Lawrence's appointment, given that there are two charges pending against him from our police force.
I share Mary's concern, as endorsed by Cindy, that it would be awkward for us to have a person on that board, which where we seek an objectivity, who has charges pending and who has made allegations against the police force.
Councilman Aaron Brockett, who sat on the member selection committee, seemed caught off guard by other council members' objections to Lawrence.
In voting to recommend him as one of the 13, was not a weighing in on the merits of his encounters with police officers that have happened recently, but speaking more to his lived experience as a young African-American man in the city of Boulder.
Darren O'Connor was a member of the council-appointed group that recommended Lawrence for the Police Oversight Board.
We chose him for several reasons, all of which we believe should be the basis for your yes vote for him, just as we believe a yes vote for the other 12 recommendations is appropriate. Sammy brings experience as a young black man living in Boulder, experience as a person who is homeless in Boulder, experience as a disabled man in Boulder. He's recently been arrested and jailed, which is another lived experience the charter called for.
After much discussion, council voted 7-1, with Brockett the lone dissenter, to create the task force with all recommended members but Lawrence. The task force will have its first public meeting on May 30th, with recommendations due to council by September 30th. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
You can find all of our coverage on that topic and what's been happening around accusations of racial bias in the police department in Boulder. That's all online at news.kgnu.org. Well, research shows that what you eat can affect your emotional well-being, and it can even prevent and manage conditions from depression to dementia. Well, that's a topic that will be under discussion tomorrow morning from 9 a.m. to noon at an event hosted by the Boulder County Area Agency on Aging. Dr. Christopher Lowry from the Integrative Physiology Department at CU Boulder will be one of those presenting at the Your Brain on Good Food event. He says there's a growing awareness on the need to have better nutrition for seniors.
As you get older, you have increased risk of inflammation and increased risk of inflammatory disease. My role particularly is focused on changes that we see in aging with psychiatry. And so we're interested in essentially a new field that's called nutritional psychiatry. And this is particularly relevant to older people.
What is the connection between nutrition and psychiatry?
So this is timely because just last month in April, a meta-analysis was published showing that dietary interventions had overall, and this was a study of aggregate study of over 45,000 people, so it's quite a significant number of participants, overall dietary interventions that were really designed to increase the intake of vegetables, fruits, nuts, oils, olive oil, so Mediterranean diet. These types of dietary interventions were able to decrease depressive symptoms in individuals. Now, this wasn't targeted toward older people specifically, but some of these studies were.
Do you think there's a challenge with seniors who have maybe had a lifetime of bad habits when it comes to nutrition, that when they get to the latter stages of their life, those habits are very hard to break?
That may be true. I think it's probably a case-by-case basis. And I think the challenge is to inform people what good dietary practices look like and why that's important, not just for your physical health, but for your mental health, including depression and anxiety.
Well, that analysis and that data that you said has just been released in April, showing, I suppose, what we would consider a Mediterranean diet, can be very impactful. Does that have pretty immediate effects? I mean, is this something that you should probably adopt earlier in life? Or if you're a senior, if you adopt this diet, you could see pretty significant impacts?
I think the latter. I think that all of these trials were really based on dietary interventions that occurred over a period of several weeks or months. And what that tells you is that if you change your diet in a positive way, then within several weeks or a matter of months, you can have reductions in depression symptoms or anxiety symptoms. One study was focused on individuals that had a clinical diagnosis of depression, and they found that there were improvements in depression scores in people that had clinical depression, although most of the studies deal with people that have subclinical depression. So they have depressive symptoms, but don't meet the diagnostic criteria for depression. And even people that are in that situation can see improvements in mood in response to dietary interventions.
Now, you did say this is a pretty new area of study in medicine. Is there an awareness now amongst gerontologists and doctors who are dealing with older people on a day-to-day basis as their primary care physician, you know, to really pay attention to nutrition?
I think among dietitians, of course, they're very knowledgeable about this. But I think among psychiatrists, it's perhaps not as well recognized. There are movements, I think, to take into account an integrative approach to psychiatry. So, for example, I'm part of an integrative psychiatry institute that's offered here every summer in Boulder. And that's really trying to broaden psychiatry from traditional therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy and pharmacotherapy to include these other factors, which are clearly important, like the diet.
Now, we talked about, say, depression as an area that can really be impacted by a change in diet. I know the brains of seniors are also prone to other things. I mean, you know, dementia, of course, mm-hmm. is a big thing. And related to that, I know high blood pressure can mm-hmm. lead to things like transient ischemic attacks, TIAs, and various different things that can impact the brains of seniors. That's another realm around diet to be considered as well. Is that something that's also being discussed?
It's also being discussed. It's being studied. It's a great point that you've made. There's overlap in these conditions in seniors. And other trials have looked at the effects of increased intake of fruits and vegetables on cognitive function and see improvements in cognitive function by increasing intake of fruits and vegetables over a period of several weeks. One of the common underlying mechanisms that may be involved, particularly in the context of psychiatry or cognitive function, dementia, is inflammation. And so we're learning that some aspects of diet can promote inflammation, while other aspects of diet tend to be anti-inflammatory. So I think the challenge is to reduce the risk of pro-inflammatory dietary factors like you would find in fast food, trans fats, for example, saturated fats, and maximize the intake of dietary factors that we know are anti-inflammatory or have anti-inflammatory factors, which includes olive oil and nuts and fruits and vegetables.
A lot of seniors aren't able to actually provide the meals for themselves. They're either maybe living in facilities where they're getting fed, or they could be dealing with Meals on Wheels, they could be dealing with other services. They don't necessarily have the full control to completely change their diet. So it seems that this needs to be an education process, you know, around all folks who are dealing with seniors, given the nutritional needs of seniors and the fact that many of them aren't preparing the meals themselves.
I think that's a good point. You know, it's not only the individuals, the seniors themselves that need education, but also the people that are providing the services. I think that's very true.
So in terms of this event that's going to be happening on Thursday, I know it's Your Brain on Good Food, and we've talked about the impact of different nutritions and different diets. You know, this seems to be something that maybe seniors can make if they are preparing the meals and if they are doing their own grocery shopping, that they could relatively simply maybe incorporate some of these foods that you've mentioned, the Mediterranean style diets. Is it something, though, that you think needs to have professional support? Do you need to talk to your doctor? Do you need to get a dietitian involved? Or can relatively simple changes be made?
I think that's the point. That was a point that was made by the people that conducted the meta-analysis, is that these are simple and accessible interventions. They're essentially no risk, and that means that individuals can make decisions to increase their own intake of vegetables, for example. One of the things that is very likely is that it's the diversity of fruits and vegetables in part that's important, and that comes from looking at our bodies more like an ecosystem rather than, you know, a single autonomous organism. And that relates to our microbiome and how the microbiome is impacted by intake of fruits and vegetables. In a recent publication by the American Gut Project, which was run by Rob Knight, one of the most important determinants of the diversity of our gut microbiome, which we believe it plays an important role in our overall health, was a question that related to the number of different plants that you eat. And so not the amount, but the number of different types of plants.
The variety.
The variety. And if you think about that in the context of the microbiome, a single 3 to 4 leaf spinach plant has over 800 different species of bacteria inside the plant. So every time you're eating a plant, you're eating the microbiome of the plant. They're living organisms like humans, have their own microbiomes that are derived from the soil. And so by increasing diversity, trying different things, or having multiple different vegetables or plants with meals may be one of the best strategies.
That's Dr. Christopher Lowry. He's with the Department of Integrative Physiology at CU Boulder, and he's going to be one of the people presenting at a forum tomorrow. It's called Your Brain on Good Food, and it happens 9 a.m. to noon at the Boulder Jewish Community Centre, and it's being presented by the Boulder County Area Agency on Aging. It was originally scheduled for March, but it was rescheduled till tomorrow due to weather conditions last March. It is exactly 8:23. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Next up, it's Make Them Hear You.
Make them hear you. Make them hear you.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas of how you can have your voice heard before Congress. Full-time work should sustain families, according to Bernie Sanders and other supporters of a $15 an hour minimum wage. They believe the Raise the Wage Act, H.R. 582, and Senate Bill 150 will break the cycle of poverty. Researchers claim that raising the minimum wage would improve the lives of 13 million children now living in poverty through better nutrition, as well as lower risks of homelessness and adult suicide. The current federal minimum wage is $7.25 per hour, a 0% increase in the past 10 years. In the meantime, just to keep up with inflation, the minimum wage should be around $8.25 by now. A dollar in 2009 is worth about 85 cents, so $7.25 an hour today is now equivalent to $6.16 an hour in 2009 dollars. The traditional conservative argument against raising the minimum wage is that it increases unemployment among entry-level workers like teenagers and unskilled workers of all ages. But in the 1997 to 2007 period, when the federal minimum wage remained stuck at $5.15 an hour, the Fiscal Policy Institute reported that states that raised their minimum wages above the federal level experienced better employment and small business trends than states that did not. Conservatives also claim that prices might be increased to offset higher labor costs. Wages for higher-paid workers might be suppressed. But if a business owner is not paying a full-time worker a living wage, the working poor have to survive somehow, and often they rely more heavily on welfare programs. That is to say, the true cost of labor is externalized from the business owner to all taxpayers. The Children's Defense Fund asserts that the travesty of childhood poverty in a country where 13 million kids whose parents work full-time yet are not making ends meet would be greatly alleviated by a $15 an hour minimum wage. They also claim that every dollar invested in reducing child poverty returns at least $7 to our economy in the long run. And the spiraling suicide rate among adults would also be alleviated with a higher minimum wage. Since 2000, the suicide rate in the United States has risen 35%, primarily because of the significant increase in such deaths among the white population. Researchers have found that when the minimum wage in a state is increased, or when states boosted a tax credit for working families, the suicide rate decreased. Raising the minimum wage and the earned income tax credit by just 10% each could prevent about 1,230 suicides annually, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research. Now, if you have an opinion on the Raise the Wage Act, that's H.R. 582 or Senate Bill 150, you can contact your senators and representative. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
And it's time now for Naturally.
Greetings, welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars. So many people suffer from allergies and can be very frustrating. So if you suffer from allergies, what are some of the natural alternatives and things you can do? Well, I do think that during the hay fever season, you want to not overburden your immune system with using foods that create a lot of phlegm. And that often means dairy products, milk, cheese, ice cream, etc., as well as glutinous products, wheat and rye and barley. So you want to focus on being more alkaline, eating more fresh fruits and vegetables. I find that pungent herbs like garlic, onions, horseradish, cayenne are really good at helping to open the bronchioles. And of course, if you haven't heard me say it before, one meal a day, green leafy vegetables. Lots of, you know, green grassy things. But what are some of the remedies we can use for hay fever? Well, one in particular that's had a lot of study and success is stinging nettles. And there was a study done in Portland, Oregon at a naturopathic college, and they found that when people took freeze-dried nettles, it really diminished the runny nose, the itchy eyes, the swelling in the face. And so consider nettles. There's also a flavonoid called quercetin, which occurs in onions. And quercetin is also great for immunity from allergies. I want to say one more thing about nettles. It's good for people that are allergic to almost everything. I think nettles is such an amazing herb. So there's homeopathic remedies, and there's a remedy called Allergia Zone 6, which is actually designed for the pollens in this area. So if you have allergies, you may find that cleaning your air filters and air duct to be a helpful thing to do your errands early in the morning, but also look at pollen counts for the day. Some days might be better than others for going out and doing your errands. Something that people used to do and should probably still do is bathing their eyes to wash some of the pollen that's accumulated from the eyes. You might also consider, I'm not big on neti pots to use all the time, but rinsing your nasal passages when there's high pollen content can also help. And of course, you know, things that are going to create more dust, sleeping with stuffed animals or sleeping with your pets or just having a lot of dust in your environment is not such a great idea. You might need to keep your windows closed to minimize the amount of pollen that comes into the house. Vitamin C with bioflavonoids might be helpful. There's an herb called eye bright. So nature might be the reason we have allergies, but it also has the remedies. So thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.
You can hear Brigitte Mars and Naturally every Wednesday morning right here at KGNU. Still lots more to come this morning. We'll have a commentary from Jim Hightower after headlines from the BBC. Then we'll hear a forum on climate sustainability. It was a round table that was hosted and presented by Sustainable Resilient Longmont at the Longmont Museum. This was on Thursday, April 18th. And the discussion was moderated by KGNU's Liz Lane. So we're going to hear that coming up just after 8:35 this morning. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU. Stay tuned. We'll have headlines from the BBC coming up in just a moment.